Hello, hello, hello. My name is Steven Pinker. Now, when I am not spending time with that great scientific philanthropist, Mr. Jeffrey Epstein, I am a great psychologist. Indeed, I am professor of psychology at Harvard University, which is not woke at all. And one of the things that I quite enjoy doing is using my position of influence to question the concept of ethnicity, to question the idea that ethnic groups are extended kinship groups, indeed, even to question the idea that we should be interested in our kinship at all. Many years ago, I wrote an article on this subject called The Genealogy Craze in America, in which I tried to undermine the importance of genealogy, undermine the importance of knowing your family roots, and to question whether you are really that closely related to your ancestors. But I was wrong to do this. And in this video, somebody called the Jolly Heretic is going to tell you why. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, today I would like to talk about the issue of genealogy. Now, genealogy is increasingly popular in Western countries, particularly with the rise of the internet. It's the most popular use of the internet after pornography, I believe. The point I want to make today is this. These genealogy websites are regarded as a quaint hobby. They're regarded as something to do when you're retired or when you have a bit of spare time. I want to argue today that genealogy websites should be regarded as dating websites. They should be regarded as dating websites for slow life history strategy people. That is to say, the kind of people that care deeply about their children, about their grandchildren, about their kinship group, and about their ethnic group. Because the ideal person whom you should marry, there is evidence from Iceland on this, the ideal person that you should marry in terms of your marriage lasting, or in terms of your marriage being fertile, is your third cousin, your third cousin, or your equivalent thereof. Now, I want to look into this later, but what I want to start off by doing is looking at the problems with what Steven Pinker had to say about this in his article, The Genealogy Craze in America. Now, the first thing he argues is related to ethnic groups. He says that if one person from one ethnic group marries a person from another ethnic group, then both ethnic groups are manifested in that person and his descendants forever. That is a fundamental misunderstanding of what goes on. And this relates then to the issue of who you should marry. That raises the question of what are ethnic groups? Ethnic groups are basically genetic clusters that are separated by endogamy, by geography, whatever, by religion, by some reason, such that they are internally related to each other. Such that, for example, two random Englishmen are more related to each other than a random Englishman and a random Frenchman. This means that what ethnic groups are extended kinship groups. You can conceive of, you know, having children, that's your, or whatever, that's your immediate family. Then you can talk about your kinship group, which is your extended family. And then you can talk about your ethnic group, which is basically your extended kinship group. Now, when people marry partners, there are various ways they can do this. And this relates to what is called a life history strategy. And this is central to what I want to look at today, because most of the people that are going to be watching my channel are going to be what's called slow life history strategists. This is not necessarily what Steven Pinker is, and this is certainly not what Jeffrey Epstein is, but this is what most of the people that are watching my channel are going to be, and this is what most people that are interested in their kinship, in their family, and in their ethnic group are going to be. Now, the way that it operates is that we all exist on a spectrum between a fast life history strategy and a slow life history strategy. A fast life history strategy involves being adapted to an unstable yet easy ecology. In that kind of ecology, food is plentiful. It's like being in a jungle. Food is plentiful. Your basic needs are met. You can survive all year round, but there's wild animals everywhere and whatever. You know, you could be wiped out at any second. So it is easy, but it is unstable. This selects in favour of living fast and dying young. What this in turn selects in favour of is investing all of your energy, all of your bioenergetic resources in having as much sex as possible so that you can pass on your with as many fit, genetically fit people as possible, such that you can pass on your genes as quickly as possible and live fast, die young. There's no point investing energy in that context in other people because they could be wiped out so that that energy investment could never be might never be reciprocated. There's no point investing the energy in individual children because they could just be wiped out. So you just live fast, die young, and invest all of your energy in sex, in copulation. Now, in extremis, what this can mean is that you will be attracted to people. Yes, of course, you'll be attracted to people who are physically fit, who show evidence of being physically fit. So in the case of men, you want women who show markers of youth and beauty, because beauty, symmetrical face, that sort of thing, is a sign of low mutational load. If you have a low mutational load, a low mutant genes, then you will be investing disproportionately less of your bioenergetic resources in fighting off disease. Therefore, you'll be able to maintain a symmetrical phenotype. Therefore, you'll be good looking. So to the extent that you select in anything, you select in people that are women that are young and women that are beautiful. Now, taking this even further, if the people are genetically different from you, highly different from you, then they might have potentially, it's possible by just luck, some useful gene which might permit the offspring to survive in this highly unstable, unpredictable ecology. So therefore you are attracted to people that are very genetically different from you. So you marry people that are as different from you as possible. That is the fast life history strategy way of doing things. As the ecology becomes harsher, colder, whatever, and more stable, then the carrying capacity for the species is reached. What this results in is the species members competing with each other. Now, this therefore becomes more difficult, because if you invest all of your energy in sex and none of your energy in nurturing the offspring in an ecology that's really difficult like this, then they could all just die. They could all just die of cold, of failing to survive in the environment. And so what you do is you take energy away from sex and towards nurture. You have fewer offspring, you have fewer sexual partners, and you invest more of your energy in them. Also, because the environment is predictable, there will be a payback for potentially you'll meet somebody again, so you'll be able to cooperate with them and whatever. There will be a payback for cooperative behaviour. So this will elevate the degree to which you are cooperative and altruistic and agreeable. And this will also select for you being nurturing as well, because nurturing people are kinder and nicer and more agreeable. And so people become more inclined to nurture. They want fewer offspring, but they will nurture those offspring. In other words, they want quality over quantity. Now, how can you be really good at nurturing your offspring? What would incline you to be nice to your offspring and make sure that they survive? Well, one of those things is that you are highly genetically related to them, because then you are passing on more of your genes. And so therefore, people who are slow life history strategists will tend to sexually select for people who are genetically similar to themselves. And there is a great deal of evidence that J. Philippe Rushton has piled up to back this up. We select for people who are genetically similar to us. We are more inclined to find a face attractive if our own, an opposite sex face, if our own face is morphed into it. We are more genetically similar to best friends than we would be by chance, based on highly genetically related matters such as wrist circumference. We are more genetically similar to sexual partners and wives and husbands than we could possibly be by chance. We are sexually selecting, and we are more similar on the more heritable traits. So we are sexually selecting for people who are similar to ourselves. This maximizes the extent to which we pass on more of our genes, because we're more related to our children.
And this, in turn, maximises the extent to which we're going to be nice to our children, to which we're going to nurture our children and be kind to them and care about them, because they are more genetically similar to us, so we will invest more in them. And indeed, it's been found even within families that people tend to bond more strongly and be closer to people who are more than less genetically similar to them, even within families. So this issue of when you are K-selected, you are more involved in and you bond more with and you will invest more energy in people who are more genetically similar to you, people who are like you. This also extends to more distant relatives, because they are, you know, you will invest in people who are like you over people who are not like you. So you will invest in your kinship group more than would fast life history strategists. You will invest in your cousins. You will invest in your friends, even. You will invest in your ethnic group. And you will regard your ethnic group as more important than would fast life history strategists. You will be a selfless person that will be inclined to make sacrifices for your ethnic group, up to and including laying down your own life for the good of your ethnic group. Because in some circumstances, if your ethnic group is under threat and could be destroyed, which would, of course, massively damage your genetic interest. This idea that if a certain number of your cousins died, that's the equivalent of you dying. It's because we are all distantly related to our cousins. Well, in much the same way, kin selection. You know, the spinster auntie invests in her nieces and nephews because she doesn't have any children, but they're 25% the same as her, so she's indirectly passing on her genes. You can indirectly pass on your genes as a K strategy, as a slow life strategy person, at the level of the group, i.e. by investing in your ethnic group, your extended kinship group. And this can include saving that group from peril by laying down your life for it. Now, similarly, people that are in this kind of situation will select for people, will be sexually attracted to people who are genetically similar to them, because they are evolved. If you are a slow life history strategist, remember, it's a predictable and harsh environment, so you are very specifically evolved to that environment. And so the thing to do is to select for other people who are very specifically evolved to that environment as well, because then your children will be more likely to survive in that environment. So people who are K strategists, slow life history strategists, will select not for people that are very different from them, but good looking, but people who aren't necessarily that good looking. They'll trade that for people who are very similar to them and who therefore will survive in that environment, and therefore their children will survive in that predictable ecology that is not going to change. And so for all these reasons, slow life history strategy people will be interested in people who are, and also if you'll bond more strongly with them, your marriage will be more longer lasting, your genes will be more compatible. Which will also mean, because you get this idea of inbreeding depression. If you're too similar to somebody, then you're more likely to have double doses of harmful genes. But this falls off a cliff once you go beyond, and Pinker admits this, once you go beyond cousin. And once you go beyond that, then your genes are more compatible. They haven't been separated for a long time. And so complex polygenic traits are more likely to work. And so therefore, people like that, people who are group selected, interested in the good of their group, their ethnic group, whatever, will tend to go for people that are relatively genetically similar to them. And the best thing to do is either your third cousin or the equivalent, which is about one point. If you think that you're 50% related to your parents and you're 25% to your grandparents and so on, your third cousin, so that is somebody with whom you share a set of great-great-grandparents, who's just outside, I think. A lot of people would regard, yeah, my cousin, that's my family. Even some of my second cousins, I know them personally, that's my family. Do you know any of your third cousins? Do you know personally any of your third cousins? I certainly don't. I couldn't name a third cousin. I don't know the names of any of my third cousins. Third cousin being your grandfather's or grandmother's cousins' grandchildren. I don't know any such people. So that's just outside family, and that seems to be, according to this research in Iceland, the sweet spot. More related, and there's problems from, you know, double doses of mutant genes or whatever. Less related, and there's problems. Now, what Pinker argues is two ethnic groups, he says, are inherently related once there is marriage between the two ethnic groups. Now, that's the case perhaps among fast life history strategists, because fast life history strategists will marry people who are just good looking and they don't care what ethnic group they are. So they might marry somebody from this ethnic group and they might marry somebody from that ethnic group. But it's not the case amongst slow life history strategists. Amongst slow life history strategists, they're always going to marry similarity. They're always going to go for similarity. Now, that can have two consequences. One is the creation of another ethnic group. So people who are, let's say, Anglo-Indian, people who in many hundreds of years ago had an Indian mother and an English father, would then marry other Anglo-Indians who would marry other Anglo-Indians, creating an ethnic group. Or they will overwhelmingly marry people of one ethnic group over the other, depending on who they're more likely to be surrounded by. So it is not accurate to say that the two groups are related forever in one person who is a product of two ethnic groups. One will dominate over the other. Now, the second thing that he argues is that, well, genetic relatedness, it drops off. You know, what's the point of tracing your family tree and being interested in it? You know, it goes back and the levels of genetic relatedness get smaller and smaller and smaller. And so, you know, so what? Why should you be interested in who you're related to? Well, the answer to that is obvious. If you are an ethnic group, then you are an extended kinship group. And so, fine, the level of relatedness within your kin to a random member of your kinship group, of your ethnic group, might be quite small. To average native English people are on average 12th cousins. So that means that they have a common ancestor about 400 years ago. So fine, they're not that related, but how related they are becomes important in a relative sense when that group is confronted with outsiders. Then suddenly, who are in a state of warfare with a competing ethnic group that is competing for territory, competing for land, competing for resources, competing to survive. Once that happens, then of course that small level of relatedness becomes important and it becomes worth disproportionately cooperating with that co-ethnic over the foreigner, precisely because you are slightly more related. And so it's in your ethnic interests, it's in your overall group interests to cooperate with them. That is why when we look at the way that primitive organisations will react to invasions by, let's say, Europeans, in general, they're not particularly cooperative at all. They are subdivided into clans and other groups and tribes, and they're fighting each other and whatever. But it's been demonstrated that in the face of invasion by people who are very genetically different from them, such as Europeans, they will come together and create a united front against the outsider, against the common enemy, against the Judean people's front. I mean the Romans. And so that is a known phenomenon. So it's completely irrelevant to try and argue that in terms of ethnic groups that the interrelatedness within the group is small. Of course it is. It becomes relevant when there is an outsider, and it's also relevant how related the group is. One of the things that I demonstrated in a paper that I did a while ago is that the more cousin marriage there is within a group, the more positively and negatively ethnocentric the group tends to be. So a group will put up a more it's been demonstrated in computer models that that a group that is high in positive ethnocentrism, that is to say internal cooperation, and negative ethnocentrism, that is to say external aggression, will ultimately win in the battle of group selection. Computer models have demonstrated that. Now, one of the things that cousin marriage does is it makes the gene pool smaller. It means that people are more related to each other. This gives them an incentive to be internally cooperative and to be externally hostile. So it could be argued that one of the reasons why Western people are less ethnocentric than some other peoples in the world is precisely because their gene pool is large. Since the Industrial Revolution, child mortality has collapsed from 50% to 1%. That means there is a much larger gene pool. We are also, because we no longer live in little villages, much less inclined to marry people that are relatively genetically similar to us, to our cousins or second cousins or third cousins. So this means that there's less of a reason to be cooperative. And it means that we are less dissimilar from outsiders. So there's less of a reason to repel them. So this demonstrates the problem with that argument. Fine, there's lots of differences ethnically and genetically within the group, but they, you have to measure them against the outsider. Then another thing he argues, which is interesting, Pinker, he says that family values are a bad thing. Family values subvert religion. They subvert other ways of holding society together. That's obviously nonsense. First of all, in Islamic countries, they are extremely religious and they have family values and they are heavily outbreeding Europeans. So that demonstrates to you that there's no contradiction between family values and religion. Secondly, religiousness tends to take that which is adaptive and make it into the will of God and promote it more strongly. And that is why religiousness is associated with family values. It's associated with pretty much anything that's adaptive. It's associated with physical health, genetic physical health, genetic mental health. It's associated with fertility. It's associated with wanting children. It's associated with having children. And so there's no way that that argument can be prosecuted. What family values do perhaps undermine is what we might call a modern form of religiosity, which is not about promoting your genetic interests, which is not about promoting your family interest at all, but which is about promoting individualism and things like that. We might call this a maladaptive form of religiosity, sort of atheistic, liberal, pseudo-religiosity. And this isn't associated with family values. And indeed, this is associated, as I've shown before on here, with poor physical health, with poor mental health, and with infertility, you know, with not having children. So yes, it undermines that. Fine, it questions that, because that's saying that society should be built around certain dogmas such as humanism, such as be kind to everybody, such as universalism, such as that life has no meaning and is pointless and whatever. And yeah, family values might challenge that, but they don't challenge religion, because religion tends to promote family values. So that's no argument at all. Another thing he argues is, well, why are you interested in your blood ties to these ancestors of yours, these distant ancestors, you know? Once you get back to a handful of greats, you're hardly related to these people at all. Then you're not really related to them. It's like a minuscule, you know, you're no hardly any more related to them than anybody else is. But that's not true, because that assumes that people marry at random. If you want to say to me, yeah, I'm barely related to my very, very distant ancestor, Ralph Dutton of Hatton, who died in 1517, who was outlawed for murder and died in 1517, I'm no more related to him than anybody else. That assumes that people are just marrying at random. If they're marrying at random, then fine, but they're not. At least slow life history strategy people, like I guess my ancestors were, marry people that are relatively similar to themselves. And the result of that is that these genetics are canalized into families. And you are more related to your ancestor, however many greats it is, than another random person might be on average, because you are marrying other people that are similar to you. You are on average marrying your third cousin or the equivalent thereof, at least if you are a slow life history strategist. And so that simply can't be argued. Throughout human history, as Pinker concedes, people have married their cousins and people that are relatively genetically similar to themselves. And so that's just impossible. And that's one of the reasons why it's been shown that the heritability of socioeconomic status, which is a reflection of things like intelligence, which is about 0.8 heritable, and personality, which is about 0.5 heritable, is about 0.7 between medieval England and 1950. The heritability of socioeconomic status is about 0.7, and that was the same in England, and it was the same in egalitarian countries like Sweden or whatever, about 0.7 heritability. Why? Because people are marrying people like them, which creates essentially hereditary social castes in which are genetically different. I mean, J. Philip Rushton showed that the highest social strata in England has, on average, a different blood type from the lowest social strata in England. They're genetically different because they're constantly intermarrying. This makes them think differently. It probably even makes them look different. And there are stereotypes about posh people looking a certain way or whatever. So again, that is no argument at all for him to say that. What this migration, it could be argued, in fact, migration in a sense is a problem. One of the reasons perhaps why people object to migration, if they are nationalistic, if they are group select, if they are interested in their ethnic group, is it makes us less related. So there, it's been argued by Robert Putnam that migration is a problem for unity, for positive ethnocentrism at the environmental level, because people who, if you have migrants, then fine, you undermine social trust because suddenly you've got these two groups and they're genetically different and they don't trust each other. But then also the natives start to distrust each other because they conceive that other natives might collaborate against them with the migrants. And so they become less cooperative and trusting with even members of their own ethnic group. So it undermines social trust. But it could be argued that what migration does is it increases the gene pool. It makes us all less, potentially anyway, it makes us all less related to each other. And so it has the potential to undermine ethnocentrism in the future. And that might be why nationalistic people will tend to object to it. So what all this means is that if people want to survive as a group, as an ethnic group or whatever, they have to have a strong bond, they have to be relatively closely related to each other, and this makes them highly cooperative and highly trusting, and it makes them highly likely to repel outsiders. And so the way this could be achieved, the way that we could create a society that isn't the kind of society that we see now in America where people are fighting each other and so on, a society where people once again trust each other and cooperate and love each other, is to reduce the gene pool. And this can be done by marrying as much as possible people who are closely related to us, by marrying the equivalent of our third cousins. Now, it's very difficult in the society where we no longer live in villages and whatever to by chance find these third cousins or people that are the equivalent of third cousins. We might find them. I mean, you'll be attracted. Perhaps they'll be that. But the genealogy websites will allow you to literally find your third cousins, to meet up with your third cousins, and that might well work. So these people that go on these sites like Tinder and they, I don't know about it, I'm a different generation, but they swipe right or swipe left or whatever. And it's all based on what you look like. It's a fast life and what you can boast about yourself. It's a fast life history strategy issue in which people are sexually selecting basically for looks and to a lesser extent, I suppose, for socioeconomic status or evidence of that. That's a fast life history strategy thing to do. A slow life history strategy thing to do would be to go on a genealogy website, find your third cousins, meet up with them and see if you like them. Because those are the kinds of people with whom you will create, on average, the most long-lasting, the most loving, the most successful, the most fertile marriage. And so to all of these incels or whatever out there, or people that are looking for love, one possibility perhaps would be to join a genealogy website, despite what Steven Pinker might say about being sceptical of their utility. Well, I hope this has been of interest, and if it has, please do subscribe. It really helps if you do that. If you want to support the channel, you will see below various ways you can do that. Please do tell people about the channel and all this, because YouTube is crushing the channel because it criticises people like Steven Pinker. I live stream on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, and I will see you soon. And goodbye!